This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. The national conversation about police violence against civilians grows louder every day. Recent killings of African Americans fuel a lack of trust between communities of color and police. In 1866, a mass killing happened at the hands of police in downtown New Orleans. That was during Reconstruction, the era Clint Bruce studies.
White people, I believe, do not understand the mistrust that many black people in the United States have of police and of authorities.
Clint says this to me as we're sitting across his kitchen table in the Bayou St. John neighborhood where he's staying while doing research in town. He's a professor at Université Sainte Anne in Nova Scotia and is working on translating a collection of 70 French language poems that were published during the Civil War and Reconstruction eras in the New Orleans Tribune, a radical newspaper run by mostly people of color.
But he wrote three poems in the summer of 1866. One of them was
Two of these poems were written in response to the 1866 massacre.
It was seminal in creating deep feelings of mistrust that I believe black people still have, that they will not be protected, and even that they can be killed with impunity.
Clint didn't learn about anything like this growing up in Shreveport in the 80s.
A lot of us really looked at the Civil War as something that was glorious. We played Confederate soldiers, all those sort, those sorts of things. It was only later, through my studies and interests, that I developed as a young adult, that I realized that a lot of what shaped our world happened during Reconstruction.
This is when Clint started to see why black people in America were and are in fear of the police. Back to 1866, 1 year after the Civil War ended, a tense year. Back then, Louisiana Republicans wanted to explore giving blacks the right to vote, so they called a convention to consider it in the state constitution.
It seems very noble, and in many ways it was, but everything was politicking. Right? And people change loyalties strategically.
Republicans arguably supported giving blacks the right to vote, partially in hopes that it would help their party maintain political power. Louisiana was under Union occupation during the Civil War and had a Republican governor by the end of it. But in 1866, Andrew Johnson was the president and a big fan of home rule, aka letting former Confederate states make their own decisions again, as long as they also obeyed federal laws. This concerned Republicans in the South, who felt they would lose ground under home rule. At such a pivotal moment, Republicans realized they needed the support of freed black men to keep that political power. And they got it. Black men, women, and children showed up to support the lawmakers in changing the state constitution.
A procession of 70 to 100 black men had proceeded to this point. They organized themselves down in the Faubourg Marigny.
I meet Karen Kosay-Bell on Canal Street, right where Burgundy turns into Roosevelt Way. Karen's a research professor at the UNO Midlow Center. She describes what happened on July 30th, 1866, outside the Constitutional Convention, when these freedmen, many of them Civil War veterans, by the way, showed up.
When they got here, I guess about the middle of the block here, they were assaulted by white attackers. They were verbally and physically assaulted, and someone shot at them. They fired back. No one was injured. They fought off the attackers and proceeded right down here on Roosevelt Way to the, what is today the Roosevelt Hotel. Back then it was the Mechanics Institute.
This meeting, by the way, had been highly publicized. Everyone around town knew it was happening, whether they were for or against blacks gaining the right to vote.
Should we cross?
Sure. Yeah, let's.
So Karen and I cross Canal Street to the entrance of what is now the famous luxury hotel.
So this is where the street was filled with men, women, and children, again, who were jubilant at the thought of an interracial democracy, the hopes of an interracial democracy.
The parade of marchers had thwarted off the mob on the other side of Canal Street, but once they made it to the Mechanics Institute, where the convention was taking place inside, they were stormed by more violence. A gang of white supremacists and ex-Confederates attacked. Fire sirens went off around the city, signaling the police to attack. They were sent there by the mayor.
There was panic because the police and the firemen, armed, surrounded the building, and the attack was premeditated. The police chief, whose name was Harry T. Hayes, was an ex-rebel brigadier general. What he was doing up to this time was recruiting policemen from Confederate veterans. They stormed in and started shooting, chasing people down the street.
When the attackers finally ran out of bullets, nearly 50 people lay dead, mostly black. You're listening to Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. Let me say this again. Almost 50 dead bodies, mostly black, lay both in the street and inside the Mechanics Institute.
There were over 100 injured in all of this, okay? You can imagine with all these people here. That's very conservative. It's thought that as many as 200, maybe more people were injured in all of this.
Federal troops had also been called in well after things got bloody, and it was obviously too late. People lay limp, heads bashed in with bricks, broken bodies thrown from windows, landing on top of emptied bullet casings and abandoned knives.
Of course, as the saying goes, it was an absolute massacre, because it was.
That's Justin Nystrom, an associate professor of history at Loyola University and co-director of the Center for the Study of New Orleans. He's currently writing about the massacre and says there were immediate consequences.
So the riot of 1866, as horrible as it may have been, was actually very useful to the Republican Party because it gave them a concrete example of the kind of problems that the former Confederates were causing in the South. It was one of those instances where they couldn't have done anything more detrimental to their own cause. And I think, in a way, these returning Confederates were given enough rope enough to hang themselves.
Justin says the Mechanics Institute massacre, combined with another massacre that happened 2 months earlier in Memphis, essentially served as a reset button for post-war policy in the South. These events were top stories in the national media and influenced voters who headed to the polls that fall.
And of course, elect a radical supermajority to Congress. The radical supermajority enacts the Reconstruction Acts, which break up the South into military districts. I often teach my students that if you don't have the riot of 1866, you probably don't have a 14th and 15th Amendment in the way that they appear.
The 14th granting citizenship to former enslaved people in 1868, and the 15th giving black men the right to vote, which passed in 1870. Despite the progress it helped achieve, the massacre was a tragedy. There were no convictions in the aftermath. Nobody went to jail. Which reminds Clint Bruce of many recent incidents of police violence against people of color.
So I'm thinking of the Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was gunned down. You know, that was settled. It wasn't considered a murder.
And the country is waiting to see what will happen to the officers who shot and killed Philando Castile in his car with his girlfriend beside him. And the day before that, Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge. After the Mechanics Institute massacre, the New Orleans Tribune continued to follow the incident for months, both in news coverage and poetry. Remember those published poems written by Afro-Creoles that Clint's translating? One of the writers was named Camille Naudin, and he was one of the most militant voices among the poets of the Tribune. He wrote a poem to commemorate the massacre.
Called Ode to the Martyrs, an elegy that enumerates a number of the victims who were killed in a pretty dramatic fashion and celebrates their sacrifice. It was written for the one-year anniversary of the 1866 massacre, so it was printed on the day-to-day the following year, the same day that there was a memorial ceremony at the Mechanics Institute.
Naudin mourns that victims of the mob were brutally massacred, while former Confederate leader Jefferson Davis remained alive and free at the time.
There was a perception among Unionists that he was getting off scot-free. In an earlier stanza, he references a former black Union soldier, Victor Lacroix, who was from a really well-known New Orleans family, who was pretty much torn to shreds by the mob.
And it ends with this really amazing line.
At the end of the poem, he comes back and he says in French, "Mais je dirai toujours mulâtre, noir et blanc, Victor Lacroix est mort, Jeff Davis est vivant," which I've translated as, "But mulattoes, blacks, and whites, this fact I must tell, Victor Lacroix is dead, Jeff Davis lives still."
Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the University of New Orleans Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the opening theme music and to Pizza Delicious on Piety Street for their additional garlicky support. Catch Tripod on the air Thursdays during Morning Edition and again on Mondays during All Things Considered. Hear Tripod anytime, anywhere, wherever you listen to podcasts. But don't forget to still go to iTunes and write us a review. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at Tripod NOLA, so follow us there. We're tweeting and posting all types of things that you won't find anywhere else. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson, and I'll tripod you later. I
Jesus.